Okay, so I'm going to talk about thermal inflation. In particular, I'm going to characterize in a model independent way what thermal inflation is. And from this characterization, I'm going to conjecture a way of how to cut off the volume in thermal inflation in a sensible way. Okay, so first of all, what is thermal inflation? Now,
sorry, can you just say what you mean by cut off the volume?
I'll tell you.
First, he's going to say what he means by thermal inflation.
And then why
even better place to start.
True.
Yeah,
it's true.
Okay. So this is work done in collaboration, work in progress in collaboration with Akani Hamed, Dubowski, Trincherini, and Villadoro and at Harvard. Okay. So, usual picture of thermal inflation is the following. We have an ordinary model of inflation, so a slow roll potential for a scalar field phi. Okay? So the universe is dominated by vacuum energy of phi, by the potential energy. And we also know that we know how to compute semi-classically perturbations, quantum perturbations around this background, and that's why, in fact, we compute density perturbations in the universe that we observe today, okay? And perturbations basically are vacuum fluctuations of the inflaton around its classical trajectory, okay? That when they get stretched outside the horizon, they freeze out, and we're going to observe them eventually as density perturbations. Now, of course, there are two possible regimes. So the semi-classical regime, in which the classical trajectory dominates over quantum fluctuations. So if the speed of the inflaton, the classical speed of the inflaton, is fast enough, is high enough, small quantum fluctuations are not going to perturb too much this trajectory, and we know for sure that inflation is going to end everywhere, more or less at the same time, apart from small fluctuations around this classical effect. In this approximation, the classical, semi-classical treatment is perfect. Okay? Now, can we quantify this? Yes, because, for instance, in 1 hour time, so from time t to time t plus h to the minus 1, the field, the classical trajectory, evolves by phi dot classical times h to the minus 1. Okay? On the other hand, we know that typical quantum fluctuations are of order h. Okay? So whenever delta phi classical is larger, much larger, let's say, than the quantum fluctuations, the semi-classical treatment makes sense and we can trust this semi-classical computation we usually do with low-roll inflation. Okay? Now, in the opposite limit, in which quantum fluctuations are larger or of order of the classical evolution, the semi-classical approximation breaks down because it means that we have quantum effects of order 1 on the kinematics of the classical evolution. And nevertheless, we can draw some generic conclusion. For instance, we can say that if these two are the same order, or this is, let's say, the quantum fluctuation is much larger than the classical evolution, we can fairly say that half of the time the field fluctuates up, half of the time the field fluctuates down. And so most of the universe, so let's say half the universe is going to evolve down the potential, half the universe is going to evolve up the potential, and this goes on every other time. And since every variable time the volume is exponentially increasing, it means that globally inflation never ends, because there is always a huge part of the universe which is way up the potential. Okay? Although for any specific observer, so for any specific geodesic, if you want, inflation eventually is going to end. In other words, the probability that every observer inflates forever is zero. Nevertheless, globally, this picture makes sense of fluctuating up and down with equal probability. Globally, inflation never ends. Okay,
and that, That happens really because you're creating observers.
Yeah, you're creating space. Yeah, yeah.
So in this language, the creation of space results in the creation of observers, which then start their clocks.
Yeah, you're saying they start the clock from zero. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So that's how you resolve. That's how you accommodate both those facts that you stated.
Yeah. Now this is the usual heuristic description with the refresh. It's heuristic because so you are extrapolating semi-classical intuition past its regime of validity. Okay. Now this is supposed to be a toy model and a continuous model for what happens in what is called false vacuum inflation. Namely, if I assume, if I trust the landscape of string theory, okay, and I assume that I have a huge field space with a huge number of vacuum minima separated by barriers, okay? Now, if the rate of tunneling between going down and going up from one minimum to the other are not extremely different, the same process can happen. So half of the time I'm going up, I'm fluctuating up to a higher minimum. Half of the time I'm fluctuating down to a smaller minimum or a lower minimum. In the meanwhile, as long as the cosmological constant is positive, I'm continuously, exponentially creating space. So globally, inflation never ended. And globally, I'm populating all the landscape of string theory. Although for any specific observer, eventually I'm gonna tunnel to the lowest energy minimum. And so if this minimum has a positive cosmological constant, I can still tunnel up because I have the Sitter entropy, which allows me to fluctuate up. If it has zero cosmological constant, it's going to be the end, in the sense that this bubble will evolve as a standard fenomenon of the universe. If it's going to have a negative cosmological constant, it's going to crash. Okay?
So I'm curious, what do you really feel it makes sense to say follow a specific observer through a tunneling event?
No. Let's follow a geodesic. Because you are saying, what are you worried about? The
well, I don't know yet, because I don't know what you're going to use that for. But specific observer most fits most naturally to me into a classical notion.
Yeah.
And I've wondered about that. I'm just mainly curious if you thought about it.
No, I agree with you. I think that this is way too heuristic. It says that these are intrinsic quantum processes.
You just want to leave it at that for now, and then you'll get to
yeah.
More
because
studio.
I'm going to deal with this. Okay,
cool.
And so what I want to say is this is just if you want this is a toy model to a continuous toy model to approach this kind of eternal inflation, which is supposedly the interesting type of eternal inflation
right.
to populate the landscape. So
right.
to start making statistical anthropic predictions, stuff like this.
But I have had people when I've worried about what kind of tunneling processes happen and don't happen, I've had people like Lenny Susskind and Matt Kleban sort of want me to think about following an observer through a tunneling event, and I've had trouble knowing what they meant by that, and so I keep. And I'm pretty sure it doesn't mean much, but I'm just basically. I want to let you keep talking, but just if you do have ideas about that.
Well, you could couldn't you, for instance, model it with a particle, a commoving particle, which is decoupled from all these fields, and it simply experiences the formation of bubbles along its trajectory every now and then. Couldn't it be that? I don't know if it makes sense.
Well, I don't want to break your. But let's talk about it afterwards.
Okay.
Because, yeah.
Okay.
I have a different question.
Yeah.
It is not obvious. It may be obvious, and I'm missing. But it's not obvious to me that this picture extends. That the intuition of this picture extends when you have a multi-dimensional landscape with a very high number of dimensions. right? Because there, if you start at some local minimum, and if you want to think of it as just sort of a random walk around other minima, it's not clear to me how much of the landscape you should expect to fill up.
So it's a question of equilibrium, right? Whether you reach a detailed balance.
In fact, I was going to ask basically the same question with one small extra comment, which is, wasn't there some papers by Douglas and company saying that maybe you can't fill up all kinds of landscapes, but, you know.
Yeah, but what's
is there, I mean, in other words, is there some assumption that tells you... do you think that you always generically populate any kind of landscape by eternal inflation or not? And is there some way to tell?
I don't know, but I don't know. But what's the argument? Why if there are more dimensions, you should because of geometric factors, you mean?
Yeah,
was it just time scales getting arbitrarily long?
Yeah. I mean, if you just look at how far you move in a random walk in a large number of dimensions, the time scale
shorter and it would be good.
Yeah, in any fixed amount of time. You on the average move much smaller amount as the number of dimensions of this landscape increases.
It's not clear.
I mean, first of all, it's not clear that the volume is finite at all. But
right,
so
it's not clear you saturate even in one dimension if it's infinite.
Right.
And the extra higher dimensions just exacerbates that, right?
Yeah.
I think
still it's
like
eternal inflation, so you have infinite amount of time.
I think something like that actually did go into this, you know, Douglas Deneff paper, I think, that was sort of saying that in even this Busso-Polchinski toy prototype or something, you quote-unquote don't explore all of the landscape trajectories by eternal inflation. It's just like not enough or something. If I understood.
So that's, I think that's a big problem with the landscape altogether, is that you don't have any way of knowing, I mean, it seems like choosing what state you think the universe is in is up to the physicist rather than the physics, as far as I can tell. But I still want to hear what
now. This is part of the confusing picture of global eternal inflation.
Thinking of infinite amount of time, infinite amount of space.
So I'm gonna go in the direction of trying to make,
especially if you start trying to thinking of forcing it into some path and then it becomes real life.
Okay.
So you're going to do it in a simple case. So we all agree that the landscape is really hard.
It's really hard.
And you're going to start with the
I'm gonna start
which is also really hard, which is already really hard.
Which
so
is already really hard, but still I'm going to show you that we're going to draw a fairly generic characterization of what eternal inflation is in a modern independent way and maybe speculate how to make sense of these infinities. That's why I want to cut off the volume. I want to give a sensible maximum volume of which you can talk consistently talk about. Okay? So, now, why is the global picture confusing? Because, again, if you want to use, let's assume that this makes sense, so that you really, in some sense, populate all the landscape. Now, if you want to use this to make probabilistic predictions, you start computing, for instance, how many vacuum of type A I have at time t with respect to how many vacuum type of vacuum type B. And of course, these probabilities are defined as infinities over infinities.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on how you regulate, you get different answers. Also, since you don't have any a global symmetry, you don't have a global freedom of the Sol-Walker universe, you don't know how to make the time slices, how to draw the time slices, and depending on how you draw them, you get completely different axes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in principle, you should use this picture to make statistical prediction. In practice, you are not able to do it. Okay. Now, based on this confusion that arises in the global picture, some authors, for instance, Busso, insist to never talk about the global picture of eternal inflation, but to only talk about one specific observer and the experiences he's going to have in this tunneling event, assuming that this makes sense. Okay. So Busso wants, basically, his proposal is, let's talk about what happens to a specific trajectory specific geodesic and see what. And let's never talk about what happens outside the Hubble horizon of this observer. Okay? Now, this is a bit, so from our point of view, this is a bit too restrictive, because we know examples in which it makes perfect sense to talk about what happens outside the horizon. For instance, sloral inflation, we know how to evolve the fluctuations from inside to outside the horizon. We know how to track them till the present year when we enter the horizon, and even experimentally, now we know that this procedure makes perfect sense. Okay, that's the way we compute density perturbations that we observe experimentally. So we even have experimental evidence that sometimes it makes sense to talk about what happens outside the horizon of inflation. Okay? So what I'm going to do, if you want, is...
So the first key thing is that things that are outside the horizon for a while come inside it.
Yeah.
Is Busso actually insisting he needs to ignore... So I'm not familiar with...
No, you're right. So Busso basically is saying, let's talk about what an observer eventually will have access to.
Right.
Okay,
so
let's talk about the past light cone of an observer infinitely in the future.
So then,
that's basically
you're not really giving a counterexample to Busso.
Yeah, no, that's basically what I'm going to do. But if you want, what I'm going to do is somehow in order to implement Busso's idea, you should first know what happens in the infinite future and then extrapolate back. Instead, what I'm going to do is try to make sense of an instantaneous description.
So you
pretty much like we do in inflation.
You want the wisdom, but not after the fact, so to speak.
I want to predict, if you want. I don't want to post-dict. No?
Yeah, yeah.
So I want to. Right. I want that the physics be able to predict things, not to post-dict.
So you want to look for the sub-horizon signatures of the future super-horizon physics.
No, not really. You'll see.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right. I want to make sense of some global picture of perturbation, but not too global, not really infinity. So as I was saying, I want to give a sensible cutoff.
And this has to do with what the observer will eventually see.
Yeah.
Good.
It's the same. Yeah.
Beginning to make sense.
Okay. So, let me. Okay, now, as we were saying, so let's forget about the landscape and let's talk about this continuous model of eternal inflation. Okay? So, as we were saying, in an eternal inflation regime, which is when quantum fluctuations are larger than classical evolution, the semi-classical approximation breaks down. Okay, so it's pretty difficult. So, you really need a full quantum treatment of the problem, so it's pretty difficult to draw robust quantitative conclusions. Okay, so let me do the opposite. Let me characterize what is not eternal inflation. Okay, so I want to study what is not eternal inflation. I want to negatively characterize eternal inflation. Okay, so let's go back to slow inflation, and then I'm going to extend my argument. So in slow roll inflation, the typical size of quantum fluctuations is this. This is the typical classical advancement of the field in one Hubble volume. This is the typical size of quantum fluctuations. Okay. So if I'm not eternally inflating, so if delta phi classical is much larger than delta phi quantum, let me square it for the sake of simplicity. Okay. It means that phi dot square classical over h square is much larger than h square. On the other hand, I know that from the Friedmann equation, phi dot square classical is g newton h dot times order one factor. Okay, so if I plug this into here, I get h dot much larger than g newton h to the fourth. Okay? So this is just saying, look, if you don't want to eternally inflate, the field must move fast enough. Okay? But phi dot, so how fast the field is moving, phi dot is related to h dot, so on how fast h is decreasing. How fast h is decreasing, so h dot is negative. And so in order not to have eternal inflation, H dot must decrease faster than a critical bound. Okay? Now, let me cast this in another form. Let me define the area of the De Sitter horizon in Planck units. So it's h to the minus 2 over g. Okay? This is the entropy, if you want, if we believe the holographic principle. Okay? So this is the entropy of the De Sitter. And on the other hand, let me define the e-folding number. So the number of the folding, as you know, is dn equals h dt. So this inequality is equivalent to, if I perform this substitution, ds over dn much larger than 1. Okay? So this is saying the entropy. So if you want to believe a semi-classical, if the semi-classical approximation makes sense, the entropy of the sitter must increase at least by 1 bit per Hubble volume. Now, this is about Hubble time, sorry. Now, this is evocative. I don't know if it has anything to do with information, etc. Maybe it's saying, look, if you want to consistently say that something has evolved, it means that you need a bit of information to change your state. I don't know. Maybe there's something.
You need
maybe
to push at least one wavelength out of the horizon and lose information about the phase, which is precisely the bit per wavelength.
So say it again.
You need to have, due to the horizon evolution, you need to have the you need to push fluctuations of relativistic fields out of horizon.
Yeah.
Fast enough.
Yeah.
So that as they go fast enough, they freeze, and you then increase the entropy by 1 bit per mode because of the fact that as they freeze, one component becomes constant and the other attributes away, and you cannot measure the relative phase.
So you're saying this is the.
It's not the phase. Well, per momentum.
Per
momentum.
Then you have to integrate. But the phase is a real number.
No, this is the squeezing factor that was calculated. In fact, I think the first paper was Zaldariaga and Kruzensky. But then, in fact, actually, there was some guy from Imperial sitting next to me that studied the squeezing.
I don't think it's 1 bit.
It's more, but
I'm really intrigued by the statement and also terrified of the papers people might write. But maybe even terrified of ones I might write. So go ahead, but it's interesting.
Okay, so if you want, here in this simple slow roll example, the absence of eternal inflation is characterized by this. Okay? Now I want to show you that these bounds, these constraints are completely model independent. Okay? In particular, they hold for a Lagrangian, for instance, which is a generic function of scalar fields, their derivatives plus also higher order corrections. Okay? Higher derivatives. Okay. So I want to show you that these bounds are in one-to-one correspondence with the absence of eternal inflation in a generic model I can write down. Okay. How do I do this? Well, I was hoping that Paolo yesterday explained our lovely effective Lagrangian for cosmological perturbations. He didn't, so I'm gonna explain you this nice formalism we developed in our paper Paolo was talking about yesterday. Okay. So the formalism is, okay, if I have a Lagrangian, what I can do is solve Friedmann equations, perturb the system around the classical solutions, okay? And so write down around the classical solution, write down the perturbed field. Perturb fields and look at the Lagrangian, the quadratic Lagrangian for small fluctuations, small perturbations. Now, there's a completely model-independent way of doing this if we concentrate on a specific mode.
You're restricting yourself to homogeneous background at the beginning.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. Yeah, because you see, I'm not talking about eternal inflation. I'm talking about what is not eternal inflation. So this means that there is one homogeneous background and only small fluctuations around it. So it makes sense to perturb around homogeneous background. Of course, this does not make sense in eternal inflation. That's why I'm trying to characterize what is not eternal inflation in order to extrapolate. Okay,
but it also isn't quite that general, because the assumption that the background is a homogeneous one out of the infinite number of non-homogeneous solutions of the field equations is...
Well, but it's like any model of inflation. No?
Sure.
You restrict to an homogeneous patch and you see what happens.
You want to reconcile it after the fact. You say, okay, there is eternal inflation, blah, 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 lots of volumes are expanding, fields roll down slowly first. You close your eyes and wait, and at some point they've rolled down out of the self-reproducing regime.
Yeah.
And they created, and then you have this sort of self-sustaining classical inflation.
Yeah, and I'm talking about this last phase, if you want.
Okay,
so, in general, of course, if I have 1,000 fields here, I'm going to have 1,000 fluctuating modes. It's a mess, okay? But there's a piece of the Lagrangian which is model independent, and it's the following. So suppose this is the field space, and this is the classical trajectory that is in field space, parameterized by time, that describes my classical solution. Okay, so the idea is I have an inflationary classical solution, and I want to study perturbations around. Okay, so at any given time, I can have plenty of light fluctuating modes around this solution. Of course, it's the dimensionality of the field space. So some of them are going to be massive, and maybe I can iterate them out. Some of them are going to be light. Okay. Now, fluctuating modes that are transverse, so modes that fluctuate transverse to the trajectory, these, as you see, are completely model dependent. So I really can't say anything about them. But the mode, the unique mode that is corresponds, that defines the fluctuation along the trajectory, okay, so tangent to the trajectory, these I can. The Lagrangian of this mode is largely dictated by symmetries. Why? Because let's see how this mode is defined. So suppose we have some metal fields that on the unperturbed solutions are function of time. Okay? Now, the fluctuation along this trajectory is nothing but replacing this function, and instead of evaluating it at t, we make a small perturbations, local perturbations of time. Okay, so we are simply evaluating the same functions at a different time, a little forward or a little back. Okay.
So this is just a formal manipulation, is that right, or are you? I'm supposed to think this is really physical.
Well, so it depends. It depends. There's a gauge mode, of course.
Right.
If I do the same in the metric, this is a gauge mode. But there's also a physical mode.
This is one way to think of the fluctuations.
Yeah. Yeah, this is one way to think
about it. Of course, that reduces to the usual delta phi of single field inflation in the conventional sense.
Yeah. In that case, in the lower inflation, my pi there, so delta phi is really pi dot classical times pi. Okay? And also here, so delta psi on this mode, so along these fluctuations, is really, is really psi dot times pi. Okay? So pi here parameterizes the fluctuations along the classical trajectory. This, if you think about it, is really what in standard law inflation in the long adiabatic limit, in the long wavelength limit, is the adiabatic perturbation. So it's a local shift in time along the same classical trajectory. Okay? While transverse fluctuations will be isocurvature perturbation. They're really changing the content of the universe. Here you are on the same classical solution but a bit forward or backward. And this can have some space modulation.
So I think you're helping me, but I was getting really dizzy because you've drawn this two-dimensional plot and it's field space, which is about more than I can count dimensions. And so am I to think this tangential direction is sort of the homogeneous piece.
Sorry, this is field space, but not...
not the spatial... there's spatial varying, and there's all kinds of field configurations. Right?
Yeah, if you want, this is a space-dependent field configuration.
Oh, that is space, right? Sorry.
Yeah,
but that's
so if you want, this is just a picture to add the intuition, but if you want, the definition of the perturbation looking at is all perturbations of this form. Okay.
What there's others. So isn't that an arbitrary change?
No.
I mean, arbitrary small.
No, because you see, I'm doing this. I'm using the same pi for all matter fields. Okay. So this is a very particular direction.
So you have many matter fields.
Yeah, I have many matter fields. You see,
one matter field.
There's only one mode, and so
yeah.
This is the mode. Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you have many, this is really the adiabatic perturbation. So it's really evolving all the fields in the same way, instead of changing the different composition, the composition of the universe in different parts of the universe.
All the transverse part would be the isocurrent.
Yeah. So in this picture, transverse fluctuations would be isocurrent fluctuations, and the adiabatic fluctuation is really the tangential. Which is defined like this with the same pi for all matter fields. Okay? Now, the Lagrangian of this pi is dictated by symmetry because this is nothing but the Goldstone boson of broken time translations. Okay? If you see this definition, forget about gravity for a moment. The field configuration, the classical field configuration spontaneously breaks time translations. There's a Goldstone boson associated with this. And how is it defined? Is it defined as usual as performing locally the transformation that is spontaneously broken. That's exactly what it is. Okay? And as for all Goldstone bosons, its Lagrangian is largely constrained by symmetries. Okay? Now, why are we interested in this pi? Because you see, this pi is really the degree of freedom we're interested in. Because a sufficient condition for having eternal inflation is that this guy fluctuates a lot along the same classical trajectory. So if half of the time I go here or I go here, this is eternal inflating. This trajectory is eternal inflating.
Yeah, beating the tangent vector,
yeah.
Displacement.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, that's eternal inflation.
That's eternal inflation.
Jumping a little bit so that parallel transport leans over, that's not eternal inflation.
That's it. Of course, I could have eternal inflation even if I have large fluctuations transverse, but I don't know. This is model dependent. But a sufficient condition for having eternal inflation is that pi fluctuates a lot. Okay, so if the classical evolution of the field is beaten by these pi fluctuations, I'm there. Okay? And so. Reversing the sign of the sign that I just said, a necessary condition for not having eternal inflation is that pi fluctuations are small. Okay, so I want to estimate the size of typical pi fluctuations and impose that they are small. Okay. So
can you just help me with one question? Suppose there is just one field.
Yeah.
When I think simply of this problem, I think whatever is happening is just a function of what the potential is like. And so where is this Goldstone boson and the arbitrary... How does the Lagrangian for pi be independent of the details of the problem?
No, of course you're going to have some free parameters, which are the parameters of the potential. But part of it, if you want, is constrained by symmetry. I'll show you the specific example of one scalar field with a potential.
By that part, you probably mean kinetic terms in couplings to gravity, right?
By that part, I mean kinetic terms in coupling to gravity. There's part of the quadratic Lagrangian of pi which is fixed. There is one free parameter, the quadratic Lagrangian, which is not fixed. And then interactions are not fixed, but different interactions are really are constrained by symmetry. So, for instance, some cubics is related to some vortex, etc. Okay. So in this sense, it's constrained by symmetry. Of course, it's not completely constrained by symmetry, because as you are saying, I can write down different potentials. But
I'm going to wait, and you're going to go into more detail.
Yeah.
So I'll just.
Okay, and I'll show you from the specific example
you're
talking
about. See how that works. Yeah.
Okay. So how much time do I have, CG? 15 minutes?
Yeah, I reserved the room until 12:30. So,
yeah.
I'm also really enjoying the informal.
I'm not in a hurry.
Yeah.
Let's go on when you are.
Just
when you're born.
When
you fall asleep, let's.
Yeah, at some point, we may transition into a place with food. But
yeah. Okay.
So then you just reparameterize and absorb this into the metric, right?
Yeah. So that's the most efficient way to construct Lagrangian. The most efficient way to construct Lagrangian is get rid of the pi, but by a gauge transformation. So make the following gauge transformation. Okay? The pi disappears. So we are now looking only at fluctuations along this direction. So fluctuations parameters like pi. So the only metric fluctuations we have is this. If we perform this gauge transformation, there is no metric fluctuation. So this gauge transformation simply say that the perturbed metric fields in reality are unperturbed, so they have the same unperturbed story. The scalar fluctuation now is in the metric. Okay? So it's like choosing the gauge, in slow inflation, it's assuming the gauge phi of x equals phi naught of t. Okay? And the fluctuation is parameterized by zeta.
So you've gone basically into this isodensity gauge where everything is in the gauge of variant curvature perturbation.
Yeah. Is it called isodensity?
You're now using
I call it unitary. But
yeah, Mukhanov variable.
Okay.
Or rather Mukhanov-Sasaki variable or whatever they call it.
Okay. Okay, so in this gauge, the matter Lagrangian, so the Lagrangian for matter fluctuations, since there is no pi, is going to depend only on the metric. So the metric Lagrangian will contain only the metric variables, okay? And what do you have to do? In order to construct the most general Lagrangian, we have to write all terms involving the metric variables, maybe in an expansion, in a derivative expansion, okay? Consistent with symmetries, okay? What are the symmetries? So the background breaks time translations, so the gauge, the residual and the unitary gauge prescription fixes time diffeomorphisms. So the only residual symmetries are, the only unbroken from the symmetries are space, are time and space dependent spatial diffeomorphisms. So of this form, let me write, which is, okay? So space diffeomorphisms. These are the symmetries left unbroken by the gauge source. Okay? I have to write down all the generic terms, all the possible terms compatible with the symmetries. Now, at the zero derivative level, the only invariant is G naught naught with upper indices. Okay. This, trust me, this is nothing but the 1 over n squared, the ABM lapse variable. Okay. Now, other invariant terms should at least involve one derivative of the metric. For instance, I could write down the extrinsic curvature of equal time upper surfaces and contract it within set in order to make an invariant. But as you will see, this will only contribute for the pi Lagrangian to higher derivative terms. So let me tell you that our proof only also include this, but in this presentation I will neglect them because otherwise we'll go on for it. Okay. Let me tell you, our proof also in the presence of these guys. Okay, so I'm sticking, if you want, to start with Lagrangians of which are functions of scalars and derivative poscalars. Okay, generic. So, as I show you, it's sufficient to consider only these invariant and to neglect terms that involve derivatives on the metric. Okay. Now, you can write down the terms, all the possible terms, and you'll see that the Lagrangian the action for metric fluctuations take the following form. So there is here here. So I wrote a generic function of g not not, which, as I told you, is the only invariant I can write down. So g not not, here I have, if you want, is my operator here is 1, so it's another obvious invariant. Okay. And these two terms have a fixed coefficient, because if you think of now perturbing and writing that, so varying the, all the action with respect to the metric and writing down the Friedman equation, you know that the Friedman equation must be satisfied on the background solution, and so terms in the action, in the matter action that contributes to the background equations of motion, have their coefficient fixed by Friedman equations. So these are really coming from solving g mu mu equals t mu mu, where t mu mu is nothing but, as usual, related to the variation of the matter action with respect to g mu mu. Okay? So it's just rewriting the Friedman equation in this very unconventional way fixes these coefficients. Okay? On the other hand, then I can write down a generic function of g not not, which does not contribute to the background equations of motion. This means it must be a function that starts quadratic in the g not not fluctuation, since I'm working in the g. So my metric signature is minus plus 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 plus. So the g not not fluctuation with respect to the background is defined by g not not plus 1. Let me call it delta g not not. Okay? So if you want symmetries, forces, first of all, everything to be a function only of g not not at this level of derivatives, and then forces these two coefficients to take precise values depending on h and h dot. Okay, so since this is a bit complicated, let me show you that this is indeed true for a generic scalar field with a potential. Okay, so let's assume that we have a generic scalar field with a potential that is driving inflation, for instance. Let's assume that we have small perturbations around the background. So the action of the scalar field, as we know, is in my metric signature is minus g mu mu d mu phi minus v of phi. Okay? Where phi is the fluctuating field. So background fields plus small fluctuation. Now, if I fix unitary gauge, which corresponds to setting the field to its unperturbed homogeneous value, so I say that phi of x in reality is phi naught of t, a given function of time, okay, and I rewrite this is nothing but before x, square root of minus g naught naught, phi dot square, 0, minus v of phi 0. Okay? Now, if you think to Friedman equations, this guy is exactly this coefficient here, okay? And this guy is exactly this coefficient here. Okay? And we have f equals 0. So if you want an ordinary scalar field with a canonical kinetic term and a potential corresponds to this Lagrangian with f equals 0. F is a generic function, so the coefficients of f are completely generic. And they can be functions of time, because time translations are broken. Okay? So symmetry fixes these two terms. Symmetry, these are fixed by, if you want, Friedman equations. And then symmetry fixes everything to be function only of g not not. And as you see, this is exactly the case in an ordinary scalar Lagrangian. So does this answer to your question?
I think so, yes.
So you see, it has exactly
the structure. So part of the constraint is just the stuff I was thinking about.
Yeah.
That's just the equations of motion.
Yeah, equations of motion,
and,
if you want.
And then this F comes about.
So F, if you
want. Because maybe more scalar fields, is that sort of where?
No, more generic, if you want, kinetic.
Oh, right.
Kinetic structures.
So this is what. Yeah, for weird kinetic terms.
Yeah, for weird kinetic terms. For instance, K inflation or fluids. Fluids, you can show that you can write down.
The symmetries don't have any prejudice about that.
Hmm?
So you're doing something general enough
yeah.
that includes that. And then
Yeah, I'm doing completely generic treatment. Okay, so you see that if you want f measures, the function f measures how far you want to be from an ordinary scalar field. You can think of f, the function f, as being zero on a scale on an ordinary scalar field and no zero on more generic,
so
no minimal.
So I guess
models.
Okay. So I have maybe a hang up about nomenclature. So if it involves v, why is it model independent?
Well, but you see that dependence on v is
already shows up in h.
Yeah,
so
it's fixed by h and h dot.
So
whenever
you
give me
you sort
h
of already,
h dot,
if you know h, you know.
If you give me h of t,
yeah,
these two coefficients are completely fixed. And in fact,
right,
in this example, they are exactly what you need from Friedmann equations.
So
it's model independent.
All the model dependence goes into the precise shape of that trajectory in field space. But then the fluctuations, you know, once you pick the trajectory, the fluctuations...
It's locked on the
fluctuations.
That
right.
You know. Okay. So you're just saying that there's this unique formula for the fluctuations for a rolling scalar field.
Yeah, unique formula. So I'm going to show you that, okay, now the quadratic Lagrangian for pi has only one free parameter, and the free parameter measures from the speed of sound. But apart from that, we are the Lagrangian for pi. Okay? Okay, so now, of course...
G0 zero has pi dot.
Yeah, so
okay.
G, as long as we stick to this unitary gauge and we look at this Lagrangian function of G0, zero, we have no intuition at all, of course. But
okay,
we can introduce the pi simply by... We can introduce the pi simply by undoing... Now that we have the Lagrangian unitary gauge, let us introduce the pi by undoing this gauge transformation. So let's now make the opposite of t in t plus pi. Okay? At quadratic order, you can see that g naught naught goes to g naught naught minus 2 pi dot plus b mu pi square. Okay? It's just a time diffeomorphism acting on g naught naught. And so, if I now zoom at small distances, so of course, eventually I'm going to be interested in the scales of order of the horizon, but we can just zoom at small distances where the physics is simpler and then simply extrapolate the results to the frequencies of order of the horizon. So we zoom at small distances. When we zoom at small distances, we neglect metric fluctuations because of pi, the mixing between pi and metric fluctuations goes to zero when you go to enough small distances. And so we can simply substitute in place of g naught naught, we can simply take minus 1 minus this combination, okay? And we get the Lagrangian for pi. So the Lagrangian for matter fluctuations at small wavelengths, small distances compared to the horizon, takes this form. Okay, where f, remember, is a generic function with time-dependent coefficients that starts quadratic in its argument. Okay, so its Taylor expansion is quadratic best in its argument. Okay. Okay. And so if I expand f, so I expand f of its argument, call it x, as being m to the fourth function of t times x squared plus higher orders. Okay, here I get 4 n to the 4th of t minus n plus squared h dot. I'm writing h dot as a negative quantity because as long as you don't violate the energy condition, it's decreasing. So it's easier to write its absolute value. It's nice. Plus interactions. Okay, so I simply expanded f. This gives me a contribution to the quadratic Lagrangian for pi. And then all further terms in the expansion of f only give me interactions of pi. Okay, so that's it. The quadratic Lagrangian for pi, you see, has two coefficients which are completely fixed by the Friedmann equation, and the other is a free coefficient. Okay? Okay.
In the case of
so
single field inflation, standard inflation, F would have been zero.
Yeah, so n to the fourth is zero.
And
you see
H dot you absorb somehow in, you know, usually you do the fluctuations by assuming that you have the background the sitter.
Well, that's a singular limit.
Yes,
no?
I know. But so there is some issue of
no. Let me do this way instead. So let me so for single field inflation, n to the fourth is zero,
mm-hmm.
And so you really have n Planck square h dot times the Lorentz invariant combination, if you want. And if you remember that zeta, so the curvature perturbation is is defined as being delta A over A now in the metric. And this, if you work out the details, is really H times pi.
Mm-hmm.
This becomes really N plus square H dot over H square D zeta square, which is the Lagrangian for the zeta perturbation in standard inflation. Not only inflation, you see, so this is not assuming inflation so far, so this is not assuming any slow roll condition, this is completely general. So a general field also Walker, if it's driven by a relativistic scalar field with some potential, the fluctuation for Lagrangian for small fluctuations have this form. Okay? Now, so for instance, as Nemanja was saying, for a generic for single field inflation, so generic, let's say, d of phi, that coefficient, which is a free coefficient, in this specific example, is zero, so n to the fourth is zero. For a fluid with a p over rho, so with a given constant equation of state, you can work out that coefficient comes out to be n plus square h dot 1 minus w over w, okay? And in fact, if you work it out, it gives you the right speed of sound, which has to be w, no? Speed of sound is given by the ratio between this term and this term, coefficient of the gradient energy over the coefficient of the time derivative energy, okay? So these are just examples to show you that indeed you can recover all familiar, this Lagrangian describes all familiar examples you have in mind. Okay, and now we are done. Why are we done? Because we want to impose, we want to estimate quantum fluctuations of pi, and they impose they don't overcome the classical evolution in order not to have a turning function. Okay? Now, what's the natural size of this transition between non-eternal and eternal inflation for pi? Well, pi, by its very definition, is the perturbation of time directly. Okay? So you want really not to perturb time of order 1. So you really want pi dot at frequencies of order h, so at freeze out, to be much smaller than 1. Or in terms of zeta, if you want, you want zeta at h, at frequencies of order h, which is h times pi at frequencies of order h, to be much smaller than 1. You want the geometry not to be perturbed by order 1 at the horizon scale. Okay, so that's exactly what defines semi-classical approximation. Okay? Well, we have the quadratic Lagrangian for pi. Let me, just to make it simple, let me call all this combination, let me call it m bar to the fourth, so it's a mass scale, m bar to the fourth. And the typical fluctuations of pi, I can read them from the quadratic Lagrangian, no? Because imagine to do canonical quantization of this Lagrangian, what do you have? If you compute now this expectation value of the vacuum at frequencies of order one, you have, first of all, 1 over m bar to the fourth, which is the non-canonical normalization of the pi dot square term. Okay? Then you have 1 over omega coming really from canonical quantization, from the fact that the wave function, if you want, has a 1 over square root of omega in front. And then you have, since you are computing these at frequencies of order omega, you want to integrate in a shell in Fourier space, so you have the Fourier space measure, KQ. Okay? Okay, now let me cast this as a function of omega by using the speed of sound. So omega squared is c squared times, so some speed of sound times k squared. This just becomes 1 over m bar to the 4 omega squared and then C cubed. Okay? So this is the typical size of pi quantum fluctuations. Now, the speed of sound, as we were saying, is the ratio between these two guys. Okay? So C squared is m plus squared h dot over m bar to the fourth, where I'm defining m bar to the fourth to be this coefficient. Okay? So let me trade two of these C's with that combination. So I get the typical size of pi fluctuations at frequencies of order h is 1 over m bar to the 4th, h squared over c, and now the other c squared, I'll trade it with this combination. This combination is nothing but m bar squared h dot times m bar to the 4th. Okay? This free coefficient, which is the only free coefficient, cancels out. Okay? Of course, yeah, so there's another free coefficient, which is c, which is the ratio between the two guys. If I impose that quantum fluctuations are small, so they do not overcome the classical resolution, I want to impose that h squared times these fluctuations, which is saying h dot at frequencies of order h, is much smaller than 1, I get h dot much larger than g newton, which is 1 over m plus squared, h to the 4th, with a 1 over c in front. Okay? So exactly the combination we were able to constrain is lower inflation with an additional 1 over c in front. Why do I say additional? Because c is going to, in any sensible model, is going to be smaller than 1. So this is even stronger, okay? Because this is an even larger constraint. So it's saying, in a completely model-independent way, whenever you don't have eternal inflation, h must decrease at least as this fast. Okay? And this is completely model-independent. This is completely model independent, also because, I'm not going to show you, but I can assure you it's true, also because you can generalize this argument, including mixings of pi with the transverse excitations, which we were, so this is pi, and we were neglecting so far transverse excitations, okay? In general, pi is going to be mixed to these transverse excitations, but if you include mixings, you can show that this bounds still holds. And still, this bound still holds if you include all higher derivative terms you can imagine, like Paolo was doing yesterday. And with the catch that it only holds if the system is not able, in his field space, to violate the null energy condition. So if the system you start with, unlike what was doing Paolo yesterday, if the system you start with cannot admit in his field space, or however field configuration you want to construct, cannot admit violations of null energy condition, this bound holds. Okay? So this, if you want, characterizes what is not eternal inflation. So and it characterizes it, you see, it's interesting because it characterizes it in a local and macroscopic way, in the sense that I don't need to know. For instance, now we don't know what's driving the acceleration now. Okay, so we don't know what Lagrangian to write down for phi potential, etc. Still, if we measure h, and if we measure h dot, we know if we are eternally inflating or not. Okay, so this is a local and macroscopic, in the sense that it's insensitive to the details of the microscopic. This is a local way to determine if you are eternally inflating or not.
Well, it determines if you're not.
If you determine,
it doesn't determine if you do.
No, sorry. But so this is a necessary condition for not eternal inflating.
Yeah.
So it means that if you find,
so we can find out if we're not.
This, you know for sure that you're eternal inflating.
Oh, okay. So you know it tells you if you are, but not.
Yeah, it tells you if you are.
Not.
You're right. It
okay.
tells you if you are.
Okay.
But still,
that's worth knowing.
Yeah.
But Nick, you are assuming something insensitive. So for the present day acceleration, I don't know if you told you, in the sense, imagine that there is a Kolmogorov constant, nothing else. I mean, just eventually you will violate that, and you will.
Well,
you would say that.
Well, if you want, is the archetype of eternal de Sitter space, no?
Ah, okay.
In the
so
sense
you are,
It's an eternal, so you know you'll end up with an eternal de Sitter space. Yeah, sure, I'm including the
so this will give you definitive information if the this eternal stage has already started.
Yeah.
You just don't know whether it might not start sometime in the future.
Yeah, sure.
Sure. That's, I think, the...
Sure. Okay, so let me conclude. Let me conclude by the following observation. So, as I was explaining you, this bound, which defines when you are not eternally plating, at least it's a necessary condition not to be eternally plating, is equivalent, you can rewrite it as this bound. Okay? As we were saying. Now, it's trivial to integrate this. This integrated means that the total number of e-foldings a model can have in a non-internal inflation, in an internal inflation regime, is bounded by the entropy at the end of inflation, if you know, final entropy. Okay? So this gives you an upper bound on the total number of e-foldings you can have in a semi-classical model of inflation, in which you can compute everything, you can trust perturbations, you have complete under control.
But what does that mean?
I don't know. You mean from the holographic perspective?
Just, I think it is, but very related or similar. What I'm trying to understand is that it does not mean you can't have more e-folds than this, except that you just can't fit them in this semi-classical picture, correct?
Yeah, but so that's true. That's true. But maybe this is also suggesting that if you want, this is a sensible IR cutoff for time, for instance, for how long you can talk consistently about the same De Sitter space.
Yes.
For instance, in the De Sitter space,
yes,
if I take a scalar and I compute the correlator between the scalar now and the scalar at times of order t, this goes down as e to the minus ht. Okay? Now, after these many foldings, so when this guy becomes e to the minus s, well, the size of this correlator becomes comparable to quantum gravity non-perturbative effects. For instance, at this level, the amplitude for producing a black hole out of the De Sitter thermal bath, a black hole so huge that it swallows the De Sitter space, which is obviously a quantum gravity non-perturbative effect,
right,
is of this size. Mm-hmm. So at this level of precision, we really have no control at all.
Sure.
On the sequel space.
On
the time,
I was just going to say, this is recurrence time.
No, recurrence time is even longer, no? Because here t is not exponential, no? T is s times h to the minus 1.
No, that, okay, so that's. So
this is
much,
much shorter
than a recurrence time.
This is much shorter.
So in the limit where you just made this nice point that the De Sitter space is like the sort of ultimate eternal inflation.
Right, no, yeah.
How does this...
It's not...
So this is saying... I'm just trying to piece together what this says about De Sitter space.
It doesn't say anything, because... This was really derived in the opposite limit, in the limit in which De Sitter space is very...
Oh, so you never get to use any of your formulas for De Sitter space.
If you want...
Because it's really...
What I want to conjecture is that
it
maybe
tells you something slightly indirectly about the future of the city space, like in this universe presently, which I think, if I'm understanding your formula correctly, it says that in a time comparable to the current entropy given by the horizon area 10 to the 120 or something,
mm-hmm,
divided by the Hubble scale, which is more or less nearly constant in cosmological or constant LinkedIn, the city space that we may end up with actually could become a black hole.
Okay.
Something
you mean
like
just by quantum fluctuations?
That's what it says.
Yeah.
So I'm saying
any semi-classical description of the Sitter we are used to, for instance, take the Sitter time and then quantize a field on it, neglecting quantum gravity effects,
mm-hmm,
because
mm-hmm
we don't know how
mm-hmm
to deal with them. Of course, any such description must break down after these many foldings, because the level of precision you need to even define, if you want, correlators after these many foldings drops below the non perturbative quantum gravity amplitudes. Okay, so if you want, maybe this is just telling you that any so since this was derived in a semi-classical models in which you can control everything, you have perfect, you can make perfect sense of the semi-classical approximation, the classical background plus small quantum fluctuation. Maybe this is telling you that even in the Sitter space, so even in a time fraction of the Sitter space, this relation is just saturated in the sense that it's saying this gives a natural IR cutoff for time, so and so maybe an IR cutoff for space of order e to the s. So at the same time, you can't talk of more that e to the s Hubble patches at the same time, because after these many foldings, maybe you really start being sensitive to subtle breaking down of the effective theory.
So your semi-classical effective theory will break down.
Yeah.
That's the message.
Yeah.
Right.
And since all the heuristic picture of atomic inflation is based on semi-classical effect,
right,
theory,
yeah, yeah.
No, just semi-classical intuition.
Finding the domain
of
semi-classical.
If you're essentially getting your detector inside the inflating patch, you will start getting, after that amount of times or something,
yeah,
you start getting polluted by Hawking radiation.
Yeah.
It just becomes fuzzy.
After this time, yeah.
But
because of this, you're saying,
yes,
because the correlation.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Now,
because
so
the correlation is not.
Let me conclude that this number of Hubble patches is exactly what the same Busso is talking about, although he's not quantifying it. But Busso is saying, I want to talk about the past Lycon of the future observer. Okay?
Because I was just going to say, this sounds like a Busso kind of. I mean, I was always uncomfortable with these entropy bounds because it was sort of more like telling you when you have to stop talking about something rather than the sort of global, it's sort of when you give up,
yeah,
rather than the really global statement. And this also is sort of when you give up,
yeah,
talking about the semi-classical,
yeah,
discussion. Does it give us insight into the global picture, though? Does it?
Well, maybe this is saying, look, as long as you stick to semi-classical concepts, so the Sitter space, every now and then fluctuations or nucleation, etc., etc. As long as you stick to this semi-classical description, you can't make sense of regions larger than this.
You know what? You can also piece that together with the thing I was kind of hinting at the beginning, is if you don't think it makes sense to follow an observer,
yeah, yeah,
through a quantum, fully quantum event,
yeah,
then this is what it means to, this is the experience of an observer.
Yeah.
And we don't know, and it might be hard to say, going beyond the experience of an observer might be hard to discuss physically.
What do you mean? This is the experience.
This domain, the period of semi-classical evolution,
yeah, yeah,
of inflation is sort of the best we can hope for identifying or measuring or somehow,
yeah,
relating to a particular observer,
yeah,
and then we may really lose control of what we're talking about when we go beyond. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
But
so
it's very interesting.
Anyway, if you want to, so this is just interpretation. It's really,
yeah,
it's really difficult to see what this is saying with respect to what you say on the Sitter space on interpretation,
yeah,
because it was derived exactly in the opposite direction.
Right.
Still, it's a result that say in a model independent way, in any semi-classical model of which you can talk consistently, you'll never get more than these many foldings, and so more than these many Hubble horizons at the end of inflation. So maybe this is just saying any semi-classical description now extended to the Sitter space, any semi-classical description has these regimes of validity. As volume is concerned.
How strong is it numerical?
Hmm?
How strong is it numerical?
You mean order one coefficients?
Yeah, let's say, suppose we have chaotic inflation, m squared, phi squared, something like that, right?
Yeah.
That takes place at, let's say, h is 10 to the 14 Jev, if I remember correctly. You know, blah, blah, if you do the Kobe normalization. That's so entropy in Hubble units, that's m Planck squared over h squared, right? That's 10 to the 10, roughly, right? So you're saying you can have 10 to the 10 e-folds.
10 to the 10 e-folds, yeah.
That's actually, interestingly enough, that's actually more or less consistent with Andre's favorite assumption that you start with m squared phi squared of order m plug to the fourth. You know, you take small mass, you take a large web of the field, blah, blah, blah. And then actually that gives you 10 to the 12 defaults. Now, you know, factors of 2 pi between friends, right?
Yeah. What do you mean between friends? So you want me to tell you factors of 2 pi here?
No, of course, that's what I'm saying. It's I forgive you and you forgive me.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, sure. Factors of 2 pi, etc., etc. But, yeah. But more than independent factors of 2 pi. That's it. That's the interesting part.
Even though I think he would say that in this m squared phi squared, self-reproduction, in fact, in the non-self-reproducing regime, so you start with this blah, blah, fluctuating, and you're also rolling down at some point in some Hubble patch, you roll below the phi star. Let's say phi star is this self-reproduction scale, below which classical rolling dominates over the quantum jumps.
Yeah.
Then, but then you know, that happens for some phi star web, which is significantly smaller than the maximal web of phi allowed to not exceed Planckian density.
Okay.
So of the 10 to the 12 e-folds that he would calculate, he would normally get quite a few less.
Yeah, which is probably...
Of course, it's consistent with
yeah.
this. In some sense, actually, you know, you might even sort of consider that you could get an even stronger bound than what you're quoting.
No, of course, you can get stronger bounds for specific models. For instance, for m squared phi squared, it's going to be less. If you want, you're going to saturate the bound when you saturate this inequality. No? So when you're keeping h dot at every step of order of g newton h to the fourth, you're always saturating the bound. And so you'll get the maximum number of e-folds.
Mm-hmm.
But whenever you start deviating from the eternal inflation regime, so whenever phi, in your example, goes much below this critical value,
yes. mm-hmm.
then you are well above this bound. So you are under saturating this bound. So
yeah,
for
you're saying it goes into the between friends numbers that we just agreed upon.
No, it doesn't go into the. I'm just saying this is really a bound, and being more than independent, I must give you.
No, I understand. What I want to do is be a little bit follow the trajectory, but that's
yeah.
okay. That's okay.
Sorry, you're saying
no,
that.
Because the 2 pi numbers here are more than independent.
I know.
So
there's still one.
What I really meant to say, I'm being sloppy, okay? What I really meant to say is that in some specific trajectory, you'll have some time-dependent function that goes into it.
Sure.
And when you write down ds by dn less than 1, in fact, it may be less than or equal to some specific function of n.
Yeah, but you must give me the specific
course,
model.
Of course.
Given a model, of course, there's
exactly.
going to be some maximum number of folds you can get. But I'm saying that, independent of the model, you'll never get many.
The bottom line is like what you say, they're basically saying that, you know, thermal inflation stops. Sorry, that the semi-classical description stops when fluctuation
right.
becomes big sufficiently
yeah.
far in the past. And then between that time
and
you
didn't understand exactly,
you get only some finite number of e-folds.
I'm sorry, I still don't understand that argument. I mean, why? What is putting your limit on S final? Why can't n be arbitrarily large and S final be arbitrarily large?
Well, S final is the S at the end of inflation.
Right.
So
there's nothing that says that in general model independent way that you can't have some region where S at the end of inflation is as large as you want, is it?
Let's see. So
very good, but it depends how you calculate it. So what's S final?
The
area of the Hubble horizon.
The Hubble horizon at the end of inflation, let's say.
But that okay, so if inflation gracefully exits, that will be finite. That will be given by some number.
No, but let's I want to follow this through carefully. So we haven't assumed that for all of
yep.
this. We're just assuming. So what functions, so we're integrating some functions h of, some function h of t.
Yeah.
Right.
And then
h could go to
the bound is really ds larger than dm. So this is giving you s final minus s beginning is larger than n total. Now, in the limit, if you want, in which you end up with a larger sitter space than the one you started with, this is negligible, and you get this bound.
Oh, that's the problem. Oh, so the problem, right? So large entropy means large H.
No, large area.
Large
so small.
So
large
entropy is proportional to 1 over H squared.
Right. So
and their S final is given by 1 over H squared at the end of inflation.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you really want to make entropy as big as you like, you need to make H very small, and it means you have to have a very, very late ending of inflation, I suppose.
Right.
So
that's okay.
With a large
right. So in principle, I guess you can construct such models, except that probably phenomenologically they're of relevance.
Oh,
okay.
No, wait. But this is... Maybe I missed it. So, but that, there's nothing wrong with that inequality, right? This S
right. I'm not
gets large, N
I'm
can
not
get large.
I'm
right.
not complaining about the inequality. I'm just saying that it isn't an inequality on the number of E-foldings in an arbitrary model. It's
yeah, it's saying that an arbitrary model that ends
with
some
final.
Yes, that's all I'm saying.
It becomes
and so
constrained
yeah.
the number of E-folds out after you specify the model.
Yeah.
But it's still true that H must be
yes.
at least as big
which
as
is also
I don't
the
know.
Of the thing.
We must have local synthesis, so H must be bigger than a certain value in any model, in any viable
why?
Model, no?
Why?
Well, because we need the universe, the Friedman-Robert, I mean, the conventional radiation dominance must start at least at 1 MeV.
You're
so
talking about the real world.
These guys.
All these troublemakers.
They actually want parts of reality to emerge from this.
No, even there, you could get H. You could have. I bet that I could come up with a model in which H becomes extraordinarily small. You get a huge number of E-foldings. Then some new dynamics comes in that pushes it back up, and then.
But
like
then you have to violate the non-energy condition, which is an assumption.
Well, that,
an assumption for all these.
Okay. Yeah.
No.
That was the talk yesterday.
Yeah. Okay.
So in conclusion, there's a fact. The fact is that any consistent with classical model inflation does not violate this bound, and I don't know the interpretation.
So,
the interpretation maybe is
it's harder, right?
It's harder, but probably, I don't know. Perhaps it's telling us something about the sitter and.
How do you think about the outside of the bubble patch in this language?
You mean in the internal inflation or in the? No,
yeah.
I don't know.
No,
I don't know.
Nor do I. this is totally an honest question.
So we won't finish that before lunch. You go,
So
just to be clear, if I just sort of pulled some numbers out of a text, pull some formulas out of a textbook and solve for H, get rid of phi dots, and sort of fiddle around, presumably I can get that, right?
You must always...
I just want to understand what the... So you did something much more fancy.
Yeah.
At least apparently it was much more fancy than that.
Yeah.
Where are you saying I needed all that just to get that formula? Or was this to show me that kinetic
curves? This is to show you, first of all, that the requirement of being internally inflating or not has nothing to do with the microscopic details of your dynamics.
Mm-hmm. And
it has to do, if you want, with the geometry.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with the geometry.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the geometry tells you if you're internally inflating or not.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
Right. And so this is the difference. So I could have presumably got this formula just by using the usual.
In a slow roll.
Yeah,
it's normal. You get the same form,
but you've just generalized it further, and that's what you.
Yeah, just to be completely sure that it's not an artifact.
You're just showing it's
it's
not an artifact of all the usual assumptions.
It's really general. Very so if you want, this is really one-to-one correspondence with the null energy condition. So if you have a model like Paolo's yesterday, which violates the null energy condition, you can screw all of this.
Yeah.
If the null energy condition is for some unknown reason sacred and you can't violate it, then it's in one-to-one correspondence with this bound.
That's nice. Yeah.
actually, what's also pretty is this way of analyzing with the phase space trajectory. It's like doing sort of like WKB of quantum mechanics in mini superspace.
Is it?
I don't know. I mean, it looks like it. I mean, in a certain sense, what you're saying is that, you know, if you can follow, if you think in quantum mechanics, right, you go to the go take a system, take the limit of big action or small h bar.
Yeah.
So you get the classical trajectory, which is extremizing the path.
Yeah.
That's what the classical solution does for the classical action.
Yeah.
Then you're saying, actually, what I really want to ask to find out whether there is a term inflation or not is to see if this classical trajectory makes sense.
If it's not overwhelmed.
Exactly.
By
so you're basically measuring just how jagged it gets. And when you say when it gets very, very jagged around this classical trajectory, you say, oh, okay, now classical limit does not make sense. I have large fluctuations. This is a terminal equation. And whether that happens, you know, longitudinally through the trajectory or transversally, doesn't matter. The effect is the same. Classical description fails. In some sense, this is what this eternal equation, as I understand, even though those arguments are typically very heuristic, but, you know, this is what it sort of says, bottom line, you know, classical versus quantum. Correct. I mean, you know, you said it. This was the definition that you used as well, right?
Yeah.
Classical role wins or loses.
Yeah.
Compared to the quantum fluctuation induced by the curvature. The only difficulty clearly is that the mini superspace mechanics doesn't have a positive definition. Well, it's Wheeler de Witt, right? So it has this sort of funny timeline direction, which is the scale factor.
This is not, is it really mini superspace? This, I'm allowing space dependent.
Well, it's like right. At the level of fluctuations, it's not.
Yeah.
But it's a.
You're allowing arbitrary fluctuations as a metric as well?
Yeah, sure. This is.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not mini superspace. It's just. Semi-classical approximation in full superspace.
Right.
Really.
Right. Once you allow the right.
Yeah.
So your background is mini superspace.
And then look when it breaks down.
Right.
Yeah, that's
right.
What I'm doing. I'm doing semi-classical approximation.
So this is the criteria: mini superspace versus not.
Who wants to grab some food?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's thank this speaker.
Oh yes. Why not?